Welcome back to the DefendoCast, the incomparable podcast where several of your favorite stalwarts and me talk about the Netflix series The Defenders. I am Lisa Schmeiser, your host, and with me as always are Tony Sindelar.
Hello.
And I am excited to announce that Nathan Alderman will be joining us again to break it down in podcast episode 4 for Defenders episode 3 tonight.
Hello again.
Yes. So tonight we have mayhem. We have ninjas. So many ninjas, guys. Yes. Yeah. Seemingly, you know, renewable energy. Forget the Stark energy as a renewable resource. Ninjas are clearly the currency on MCU. We have ninjas. We have Alexander dropping more broad clues about how old she is. We have the return of Elektra. I would call it triumphant, except it looks like she has to relearn everything from scratch. We have Luke and Danny, going on like an arranged friend date, courtesy of Colleen and Claire.
Let's be honest. It's a play date.
Yeah, it's a play date. It goes about as well as can be expected, too. And finally, the episode ends in what we've all been waiting for, which is to say all four defenders in the same room at the same time, surrounded by ninjas. So before we get started, let's get into our flash recap. Those of you in the know are nodding along as you wait to see whether or not Tony is up to the challenge of recapping the episode's events in under 60 seconds.
I'll try.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to count you down and then we'll get started.
Mm-hmm.
And 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go.
So the episode starts with Alexandra in the past overseeing Elektra's kind of resurrection and recovery from death, which takes a while. In the present, Stick is being interrogated about what he might know about Iron Fist, and he cuts off his own hand in order to get away. That's dedication. Matt and Jessica Jones chat, but they are not exactly becoming fast friends, and they split up pretty quickly. Claire attempts to play matchmaker for Danny and Luke, also to somewhat limited success, but there's some good character moments and conversations here. So the characters kind of interact briefly, but then kind of head off in their own directions. They're all continuing to work on their own various mysteries that they're solving, but basically they all end up at the same place, Midlands Financial. Danny kind of arrives first and busts into what looks like it's going to be some kind of corporate meeting, but it turns out everyone at the corporate meeting is a ninja. And there is the crazy fight scene that you saw in all the promos for the Defenders, which is entertaining. And then they all escape in an elevator. The end.
There you go. That was 70 seconds. Well done. To be fair, there was a lot.
And there was a lot.
I blame the ninjas.
I blame the ninjas, too. I you know, yeah. In my simplification, I probably forgot to mention probably one of the more amusing segments in this is, as part of her investigation, Jessica Jones pretends to be a potential client for an architect.
she channels her don't.
Yeah.
Don't trust the B persona in delivery, and it's genuinely unsettling to hear it.
Yeah, I love those little glimpses of the person that Jessica could be if she weren't an alcoholic, traumatized wreck.
I don't know if Jessica would ever be as blithe and
shallow.
Yeah, and that's a good way of putting it, is because the consistent non-alcoholic traits that we've seen, this is somebody with a boundless sense of curiosity and an incredible eye for detail. Because when she starts resetting, standing desks, of course, and wellness and yoga and a juice bar and all that, like, you can tell she's basically like flipped through three people's Instagram feeds, rolled her eyes the whole time, but somehow managed to tick all of the cultural tells, and she's just throwing them back out there to fool people.
Is it three people's or is it just Trish's? So
it's 100% Trish's.
Oh, it burns. Oh, I need some aloe vera for that.
I love when she takes the call to set up the meeting. Watch Kristen Ritter's performance. Her whole face changes.
Yeah.
Suddenly, her eyes open. She brightens up. She smiles. She is, for a moment, that entirely other person.
Yeah.
It's a neat bit of Jess's character. And anyway, yeah. I've got more to say about that later on.
Oh, my. No, we can talk about it now, because Jessica Jones in this episode, again, you see her curiosity get I wouldn't say get the better of her, but Jess is clearly somebody who, when there's a question that's nagging at her, it's there is nothing that stands between her and getting an answer, because she twigs to something off about Matt and she can't put her finger on it. And so she investigates him.
And I think that's part of her general sullenness. It's like, you know, oh, there's a mystery that I can't solve. I'll show you. I'll solve that mystery.
Which why is a fun... are so many things incomprehensible to me?
And I love her costuming more than, I mean, Daredevil's costume has gotten better over the seasons, and I like that. And I love Luke Cage's, you know, yellow hoodies and whatnot. But I love Jessica Jones's costume more than any other costume in the Netflix MCU, because it says so much about her. It's so many layers, even whether it's cold or warm out. She's always wearing layer on layer on layer on layer. She's got the scarf wrapped around her neck. She's got fingerless gloves. It's like she can't. This is someone who could lift a bus. And she can't bear to be in contact with the world. And yet, when she goes to the architecture firm, you see her peeling off layers of that that outfit to become someone else. And she can, I like that she can take off or put on different layers of the outfit and become different kinds of people.
Yeah.
And then later in the episode, we also see another useful use for her scarf.
Yeah, I like how quietly political Luke Cage's costume is.
Oh, it's great.
A black man wearing a hoodie is a really potent cultural signifier.
And especially a bulletproof black man wearing a hoodie that is always riddled with bullet holes.
Yeah. And when he puts it on, I think the costumers and the people who make this show are sending a very deliberate message about how we choose to see it or what we choose to see in it. And so I really enjoy that. So yeah, there's that costuming. You know, you take a look at that. I also find it interesting. Like you said, I don't really like Matt's Daredevil costume, but that's because I really thought the black shirt looked good on him.
It did. It grew on you.
It gave you a more natural and organic sense of his physique. But I think one of the functions that the Daredevil costume serves is it helps Matt's compartmentalization.
Yeah.
Where when he puts on, it's the visual manner. It's the, when he puts it on, it is him literally putting on, it is him literally shrugging into that part of his personality that he doesn't want anyone else to see.
I also wondered, like, in that Daredevil season one was the first Marvel Netflix show, like, if they felt this is a superhero show, there eventually has to be the costume.
And
they, you know, I mean, I wonder if they're kind of a little bit more comfortable because that show was successful and well-received, not having to lean into that with the other shows, because where the other characters don't have a ridiculous superhero costume. They may have things that kind of hint at superhero color schemes and whatnot. But I wonder if some of that is just like, we don't actually need Danny Rand to be in his ridiculous Iron Fist plunging neckline costume, because it's not going to work.
I don't know. If I go see a superhero show, I want a costume, at least on Daredevil. Somebody's got to have a costume. And it might as well be Daredevil, because he's the most theatrical of the bunch. I don't need Danny Rand's high collar plunging neckline, but some of the Bruce Lee inspired tracksuit stuff and a mask would not be amiss for me.
See, that would be great. The Bruce Lee, because again, what you'd be doing is you'd be borrowing a whole bunch of imagery there.
Oh, wait, actually, maybe not, considering that cultural appropriation is already a pretty big problem for Danny Rand.
I don't know, man. There's a little bit of Beatrix Kiddo going on there, too. So
I was a little confused by kind of the lead up to the fight scene where Matt Murdock takes Jessica Jones's scarf and has it over his face like a mask. But
like a mask, but in reverse.
Yeah, it was kind of weird because it's like, I guess especially it threw me when he's like doing his crazy kind of parkour moves through the office building to get to the place. And it's like, you're kind of like, I get that you're probably trying to protect your identity, but in a way you're kind of making yourself look more conspicuous, because
I know.
Because you could just be a guy booking it through an office building, and instead you're a guy like with a scarf over your head and it's only covering half of your face. That's what throws me.
I think that's a great representation of Matt being really bad at his dual life. You know, he's terrible at it, and that it's kind of like this compulsion for him to put on a mask and go running to danger.
It's a security blanket. He literally took Jessica's security blanket and made it his security blanket.
And it's also kind of guilt. He wants to hide his face because deep down he feels like he's doing something bad every time he becomes Daredevil. So he wants to hide his face.
bear in mind, he's blind and doesn't realize how flippin' freaky it would look if he actually just wrapped it around his entire head.
Yes.
Like, so, if somebody said to him, Matt, you're never going to see this, but we need to tell you that you covering the top half of your face only confuses people. You covering all of your face would be genuinely awful. And he'd be like, oh, it's a psychological advantage. And he'd do that. But yeah, he covers the top of his face and you're like, okay, this is supposed to be a shout out to Daredevil. And yes, he's blind and all that. But think about how unsettling. And again, he needs a sighted friend to explain this to him. Like, think about how unsettling it would have been if even he had covered the bottom half of his face and you've got these sightless eyes that are looking nowhere near where he's actually moving or fighting.
He just needs a domino mask or whatever is available at the Halloween store for some kind of full head mask.
You get the sense it's a security blanket thing for him where he's like, well, if I'm switching from Matt Murdock mode to Daredevil mode, I can't let people see my face, and this is how I do it. And, you know, again, not sighted, doesn't have a whole firm grasp on the visual messages he could be sending, and nobody to say to him, no, cover your whole face, that would look cool. But before we get to the fight scene and how people and how it's how many different ways it's great, I want to talk about the episode leading up to it, because there is, again, you know, to get back to it, Jessica investigates Matt and finds out that he moves around like, quote unquote, like a Russian gymnast. Actual quote she uses later. And you find out that she's kind of irritated that whoever sent the lawyer sent a blind gymnast lawyer. And then we also get what I consider to be the non-fighty showpiece of the episode, which is that Luke Cage, in addition to being the beating heart of the series and the moral backbone of the series and the personification of decency and responsibility and also incredibly handsome, is also the dude who, unasked, decides to try to explain white privilege to Danny Rand.
noted spoiled billionaire Danny Rand.
Which goes about as well as anyone having white privilege explained to them for the first time.
But bless his heart, like, he tries. Like, he genuinely goes into it with the conviction that if he can make Danny realize that, you know, billionaire men who punch poverty-stricken black people are not on the right side of history. Like he breaks it down and tries to make Danny understand, you know, the difference between privilege and not having privilege. Like, at one point, he tells Danny, you had power the day you were born. You had the ability to change the world without anybody getting hurt. And to me, that line is perfect for so many reasons, because it points out that, you know, look, you have a lot of inborn resources that you could use. And what's more important, you could choose to use these resources in a way that makes society better without hurting anybody. There is literally no reason for you to go pounding henchmen and flunkies just because you want answers. And, you know, time will tell if this actually sinks in for Danny. But, like, the fact of the matter is that Luke actually respected him enough as a person to bother to try.
Hmm. And, it's also, it's kind of the reminder. I guess this is, like, the anti-Daredevil season 2, like, ninjas are people too. message, right? Like, you can't just punch every henchman. And it's like, you know, Danny Rand should know this based on the events in Iron Fist where, like, you know, there are people that are part of the hand that have basically been tricked to being part of the hand, right? And in this case, they're not even the people he's beating up that Luke Cage is so outraged about are not even the hand. They're people who have been hired to be part of some cover up for the hand.
And then killed by the hand afterwards. Like, this is the thing that they make blatantly clear is that the hand considers its workforce disposable.
Yes.
And, you know, Danny doesn't seem to get that people don't have the same choices he had. Because, again, part of what frustrated me about... There are many things that frustrated me about Iron Fist Season 1, but one of the biggest frustrations is basically the plotline can be summed up as a billionaire enters into a legal fight with other billionaires over who shall control a multinational corporation.
Yes. And, also Kung Fu.
Yes, yeah. Occasionally. There is the weird thing where Danny does not seem that culturally changed by having grown up in a monastery, which confuses me a great deal. right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
yeah.
In Iron Fist, in one of the, it's only a passing thing, but it is shown in several episodes. Like, he buys an incredibly fancy car, and it's like, really? Like, he's a monk. Shouldn't he just be like, yeah. Nah, I'm okay taking, you know, he should be like
for
I'm
a dude
okay
who
walking
showed up barefoot. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm okay walking to work every day. Maybe I'll buy some shoes eventually.
Yeah.
Like, it just seems like, how did you even know which ridiculously fancy car to get, right? I mean, it just seemed like,
yeah.
Why would you?
Because
do that?
He's
like, you
he's
find
not
yourself, yeah.
He's a 12-year-old boy. His development yeah. stopped the instant his he saw his parents get sucked out of a plane.
Yeah.
Like, you find yourself sympathizing with Ward and Joy because they have literally spent their entire adulthood training to take over a corporation from their dad. They went to B school. They are workaholics. They are practicing careful stewardship of a corporation that's responsible for employing thousands of people and reporting to shareholders.
Yeah, Lisa,
and then
he hugged a dragon. He hugged a dragon.
Yeah. Then along comes this dude who's all, I punched a dragon. I don't wear shoes. Now give me my company. And I'm like, oh, you know, it's hard to see you as going on the hero's journey here. So
he hugged a dragon. Give him his company.
So what I really appreciate about this episode is that so many people in it, from Claire to Colleen to Luke, all try really hard to beat it into Danny's head that if you're going to go around punching people, maybe have an ethos attached to it that isn't, but I want answers. You know?
Which, again, he doesn't learn until the very end of the episode,
yeah.
In which he learns a little too well. That I want answers is, and I'm going to punch you, doesn't work mm-hmm. for him in all
oh
situations.
God. I had a full body cringe when he like confidently strides into this boardroom filled with strangers and headed up by Alexandra. And he's like, I have receipts and I can prove you're doing terrible things and I'm going to take you down. And she's like, I have actually killed smarter Iron Fists. And like, it literally took me 3 tries to get through that scene without having a full body cringe. Because I was just so embarrassed for him.
I'm Danny Rand, and I would like to speak to your manager.
Yes!
I don't know. For me, watching Sigourney Weaver sass Iron Fist was the thing I never knew I needed in my life until it happened.
Right?
Sigourney Weaver does not throw shade. Sigourney Weaver throws the entire 100-year-old old-growth oak tree.
Yeah.
It is hard though, because I keep thinking of her as hottie vampire, hottie as in not attractive,
in,
but an arrogant vampire.
Yes,
because
arrogant
like
vampire lady.
It does
yeah.
remind me, like it's. I feel like there are characters from Buffy the Vampire Slayer who you know who'll be like, let me establish how bad I am by name dropping the fact that I've killed 3 Slayers before, or let me
yeah.
tell you about how great it was attending like the crucifixion. I am
yeah.
super old and awesome. I
yes.
don't have time to do anything that would show you how awesome I am. I'm all talk. Also, I'm not going to be around after this season because that's the formula of this show.
I spent the Middle
know.
Ages snacking on children. You'll be nothing.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh God, really?
I don't know. Sigourney Weaver, the way she carries herself, you kind of feel mm-hmm. like she's earned that hauteur.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great choice of actress and part.
So what
regard.
Do you think about Alexandra's decision to eat alone? Because this episode begins with her doing that. And again, referencing, I'm so old, I was calling it Constantinople
yes.
and all that. And then you see another member of the Hand, this one, an African warlord, because why not just lean in hard to that cliche? And he apologizes because he knows that she doesn't like to be disturbed while she eats. And
is it progress for the Hand that they're not just ninja cliches, that they're also other
that there are also other
that we have an assortment of cliches that are not great.
They have a veritable United Nations of cliches at this
yeah.
point. Yeah,
they represent like all 5 inhabited continents. Alexandria
yeah.
is clearly Europe.
Mm-hmm.
The guy who was Colleen Wing's mentor, whatever, he was South America. The warlord guy is Africa, and you know he's an African ninja.
Gao,
so you know,
and Madame Gao is Asia. So
is
yeah.
Asia, and
there's just
like
one
there, like,
mean penguin really gunning for that 6th seat. You know,
well, Australia. Like, do you think that they just got? Do you think that they're like, no, Australia is just way too deadly. Even immortal people wouldn't be able to last there because of the drop bears and the magpies and the spiders.
Thank you for
jellyfish.
Mentioning drop bears before I did. That's
mm-hmm.
great.
Yeah,
I'd say. They'd just be too easygoing. You mean I'm immortal? Great. I'm going to sit here in the sun and drink beer all day.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
you guys have fun conquering the world.
Nathan, we're
going to
get mail now. We're going to get mail.
Nathan, I kind of want to see a series about a bunch of immortal Australians at this point, where it literally is them just, you know, surfing and dorking around Australia for hundreds of years. That would just be amazing. That would be great. Yeah, they end up getting press ganged from the UK, and they discover happily after, oh, I don't know, let's just say a random magpie attack, they're all immortal.
Well, you know, if you're going to discover that you're immortal, Australia is a great place to do it, given all the deadly fauna.
Yeah.
I visited Australia as a kid. I love Australia. I'd go back in a heartbeat. Everyone there was so nice. And I, aside from all the deadly animals, I can see why it's a very nice place.
Yeah. So I would argue, the first third of the episode is basically Alexandra, acting as a very surprisingly maternal figure to the Black Sky, which I found kind of fascinating. Mothering a weapon, I'm sure there's like an undergraduate paper in there on the profound female symbolism of it all, but you know, this is a podcast where we just kind of zip through things. But we see Alexandra mothering the Black Sky as Elektra gradually regains some ability to speak and some semblance of consciousness. But they do make the deliberate decision that, you know, when she's resurrected, she's confused, she's in pain, she's screaming, she's disoriented, but she still has her fighting instincts intact. It's the fact that you have to overlay some humanity onto that, and it's interesting that they chose to do it that way.
This was my least favorite sequence of the entire series, because it is 13 minutes with zero stakes, including tons and tons of the director for this episode. He was like, I'm the fight guy, and they're like, yes, that's why we hired you for the last 10 minutes of this episode, but you might as well just throw in some other fights. But none of the fights in that 13-minute flashback have any stakes. You already know what's going to happen, because you know Elektra's still alive. It's not like, and then the ninjas killed her, and you know they can't resurrect her again, because they say as they're resurrecting her, this is the last time we can resurrect someone. You could have cut that down to 5 minutes. And we'll see later, in a later episode, why Alexandra is mothering the Black Sky. And that is neat, and that is worth keeping. But you could have cut all the pointless, endless fight scenes, and Elektra looking at a pair of scythes on the weapons rack and going, those look familiar.
Yeah,
because she does it again later.
There's a lot of very meaningful looks at her old familiar weapons. But I am pretty fascinated with the fact that Alexandra chooses to act so maternal towards a weapon. I think it's an interesting character choice.
So it is, and it's one of the things that humanizes her. Sorry, I keep talking over Tony.
Yeah. No, that's cool. I guess the question that this... So, again, I haven't seen any further. I'm watching as we podcast. This episode raised a lot of questions for me about how the mechanics of the hand's resurrection abilities, because that was something we saw a lot in Iron Fist. And I guess... I'm just already prepared to be disappointed by whatever the explanation is, to the point that, like, maybe I don't care already. So
it's a MacGuffin.
Okay,
you don't need to care about it. It's just a big MacGuffin.
Because that seemed like a big deal in Iron Fist, right? Like, there's a lot about that in Iron Fist.
Oh, and in Daredevil too. Like, all of Daredevil season 2 is the blood farm.
Yeah, and now it almost feels like, well, we kind of need to get around that a little bit, because, like, guess what? If we can always bringing people back is super easy, that's not such great storytelling, because death is not permanent. I don't know.
Without spoiling anything, you will find that it is both elaborate and weirdly mundane.
Yeah. Okay.
Ninjas. It's kind of like an episode of Iron Chef in a lot of ways. Like, you're given a bunch of ingredients, you have a time limit, and the best part is not watching the cooks do their thing. The best part is watching Chairman Kaga floridly stroll around the stage in a cloak. You know,
that was my mistake, as I watched all of Iron Fist and said I should just watch repeats.
Watch
of
all
Iron
of
Chef.
Iron Chef. Yes,
well, there's a lot of Iron Chef, but yes, I could have watched one for one Iron Chef and Iron Fist.
Yeah,
I'd be in a better place. So.
Yeah, the chairman is clearly a better choice. So the first third of the episode was, okay, we've established that Elektra is back, and that's why people have been fighting her for the last two episodes. Bum bum bum, and
I almost feel like she was in the last episode to just make sure you didn't forget about her. Because she was present in episode 2, like, not really for any reason.
I enjoyed that I enjoyed that Elektra was in an episode where she was around Jessica, because Jessica is one of only two characters in the Defenders. Because what the heck? Let's just call them the Defenders at this point. They've all met. Jessica is one of two characters in the Defenders who will not, upon encountering a ninja, immediately go into kung fu. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm honestly surprised Jessica didn't whip out a gun, because, you know, it seems to me that would be a very sensible way to deal with the surplus ninja population. And yet so few people think to try it.
Thinks of herself as a weapon. The difference, though, is that unlike Elektra, she's never embraced it. In fact, she's actively running away from it. Because unlike Elektra, she's fully cognizant of the damage that weapon can do. And that's really interesting. I never even thought of it until now, and they should have played that up more. Both Jessica and Elektra have been used as weapons. They have been used to hurt people, to kill people, and it would be interesting to play more of that contrast, and they never really do.
No, but you do make a good point about Jessica's physicality, because I feel like we've talked about much of it. Let's get to the stuff we really want to get to, which is through a series of highly improbable yet completely plausible plot turns, everybody ends up at Midland Financial, right? As Danny is busy iron fisting Abel. Oh, that sounds really dirty. Right as Danny is busy being the iron fist with a bunch of ninjas. So Jessica ends up there, and Matt ends up there, and Luke ends up there. And the Matt and Luke stuff, by the way, is fantastic. Where, now we're okay with punching. Yeah, we're okay with punching. But one of the things that I find really interesting about the fight, and that I loved about it, because I did love the whole fighting sequence, but one of the things I thought was so great was you see how uncomfortable Jessica is with fighting. And she pretty much only does it when she's really annoyed or when someone's trying to kill her. She, out of the four of them, she is the one who seems to derive the least satisfaction or regarded as the least necessary. Like, Luke is mostly a defensive fighter, and he's like, okay, this has to be done, because otherwise this idiot Danny is going to get shot with darts and blah, 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 here I go. And, you know, Matt is like, "Wee, ninjas!" and jumps into the fray. And Danny, of course, is just, it's like watching a Labrador Retriever and a hamburger. There's just going to be like a built-in, but Jessica is kind of like, oh my God, really? Really? This is what it's come to? It's come to this. I have to punch somebody now. And you see her do it, but she doesn't take any
no
sort of
satisfaction, right? Punching doesn't solve mysteries, right? It's just a thing in the way of solving a mystery.
And it doesn't solve problems, because like we see her when she solves Trish's problem when she's like, oh, is there a problem with the car? And all of a sudden there's no problem with the car. And, in this episode, she's like, okay, fine. Punching, the only problem the punching solves is no one is trying to kill me right this minute. But, you know, she doesn't take any joy in who she is, you know? I mean, or I should say rather, she doesn't take any joy in her physical gift.
And I think that's important in a show where all four people, and some wag on Twitter noted this, it's a show about four people who have the powers of punching people, and punching people.
Yeah.
But it works because they all do it in different ways that reveal their character.
Yeah.
And I love that little moment when Matt has finished parkouring his way up the building and runs into Jessica just getting off the elevator.
Yeah, no, that's perfect.
It's a great use of action to reveal character.
Yeah, it's just perfect because I think it also speaks to how Matt in his way, I mean, we joked about how for Danny fighting is a performance, but I think there's an element of that to Matt too, where his fight starts when he puts on the suit and gets himself into his mindset. And so I think part of Matt parkouring his way up there was him shifting his mind from Matt Murdock to Daredevil. And,
Dad was a boxer, and boxers have that elaborate warm-up ritual. You put the hood on, you get your knuckles taped, you get into the ring, and the announcer calls your name. And so, I agree with you. I think he needs that to get psyched up.
Yeah. Also, it kind of, because his Catholicism is such a big part of his character, ritual is such a big thing, right?
Yeah. Whereas Jessica has no intention of fighting. She just wants to find out what the heck is going on and what it has to do with her client. And so when she gets, you know, the elevator is the most expedient way for her. She's not looking for a fight. She walks into one and she's all, oh God, really? Really? This is how my day is going now? And takes it from there. And when she moves, there's no physical grace to it whatsoever. There's no technique at all. It's just her It's just her trying to stay alive. And even in that, you know, Luke has a little bit more of a physical elegance to it, I think, because Luke kind of enjoys the fact that his body can be used to protect and shield while he does something else. But Jessica doesn't see it that way.
Yeah, and Jessica's stunt double in the fight scene is so glaringly obvious that I would love it if they cut over from the stunt double being thrown into a wall to Jessica on her phone looking up, going, ugh, and looking back to her phone.
It seemed like they kind of featured Jessica the least in the fight. Maybe part of that is because they didn't have, I mean, Jessica Jones, the show, did not have a lot of fights in it, so maybe they don't have as a go-to stunt person to use for everything. But yeah, I kind of felt like she disappeared in the fight and then is there at the end. And it's like, well, I guess there's four characters. There's only so much you can do. But I felt like she was conspicuously not present for a bunch of it.
Yeah, I feel like that kind of makes sense for her as a character.
Yeah, maybe I'm willing to buy that.
Yeah, and I do enjoy the fact that when Danny has his first, I do enjoy the fact that with the exception of the opening in episode one, like Danny's big fight scenes have largely been the result of his own idiocy. Because first there's him facing off with Luke, which is completely unnecessary, and yet something that Danny prompted with his own idiocy. And then there is the fact that Danny has just trashed the boardroom of Midland Financial, all because of his arrogant stupidity. Like, it's just arrogance, and it was really hard. I had a hard time rooting for him because I was like, Danny, this was so dumb. You know, why didn't you talk to Colleen about how to do stuff? Where is she? Why is she? What is going on, son?
When all the board members turn out to be ninjas and it's like, oh, come on, you guys, you didn't do any like background reading on this. Like,
yeah.
Don't walk into
an MBA that offers a minor in ninjutsu.
You know, I would not rule it out. No, I say this in all seriousness. So the place, I went to a school called RPI, Rensselaer, and I lived with a couple dudes in the MBA program, and they were actually all made to join team sports under the theory that if you were on a team sport that required practice and discipline and competitiveness and an incentive to excel, those skills would translate well into any corporate setting. And so it would totally not surprise me if there were some B school overseas where they're like, oh, yes, and you're going to become a ninja.
Ninja is not a team sport, is it? I don't know. It seems like there's a lot of fatality rate.
Ninja Corporation, the series. Everyone like secretly assassinating each other over lunch breaks.
Project managers have to hide in fear for their lives and they blow
always delivering files on like throwing stars. So
exactly.
They turn the files into throwing stars because they take a hint from, oh god, what was his name in Iron Fist, who was Danny's best friend, and I'm blanking on the name of the dude who should have been the
Davos.
Iron Fist.
Davos.
I was like, it was a Rich Person Summit name. Yeah, like, because remember Davos's introduction was he took the hot dog foil and turned it into a lethal shuriken. Mm-hmm. Like, maybe that would be a ninja the series, corporate ninja the series. But yeah, I loved the fight scene because when you shoot a fight scene in a hall well, it is a lot of fun to watch. And it is especially fun to watch when Luke is just throwing people through walls and following up all, it's just drywall. And that was enjoyable. For me, the least enjoyable part of the fight was Matt and, my dead ex. And so, oh God, here
Lisa,
we go.
It's not quite the same thing, but I feel obligated to mention that there is a web comic that is called Dr. McNinja about a doctor who is also a ninja. And that might
web comic
that might, it's not exactly what you've asked for, but it might be the closest that we currently have available. I just thought that was important to mention.
Well, yes, I highly recommend Dr. McNinja. I wanted to mention briefly that Midland Circle, the colors of Midland Circle and the set design are deceptively great.
Yeah.
It looks like, oh, they didn't bother to decorate this set. It's just an anonymous bland hallway. But Midland Circle is all in Alexandra's colors, cream and silver and gold. It's this great way of visually emphasizing that Danny Rand is walking right into her trap, into this place where she has power.
Yeah, I feel like the set decoration and the costumes on TV shows don't get the credit that they should for the incredibly heavy lifting they do to establish ambience and to underscore characterization and plot and to telegraph what's going on. But you're absolutely right here.
And especially for a studio as notoriously cheap as Marvel TV, they do a lot with a little on this series.
They really do.
Yeah, it's really good.
And the music. The music is great. Not just the score. I love. Mm-hmm. So for me, the scene where Matt and Jess are following each other on the street.
Oh, that's such
flat.
A good sequence.
It didn't work to me visually, but the music is incredible. The music is for the scene that it should have been.
Mm.
It's fun. It's playful. It's tense. Of all the pieces of music in the series, I really like that one. And then I love that when Danny Rand is pinned down to the boardroom table, about to get dosed with goof juice by the ninja MBAs, this little bit of Run the Jewels, this little bit of electric feedback comes in just before Luke Cage shows up to kind of it's like his announcement music. And then
that's Luke Cage's entrance music.
And I think it's a Run the Jewels track. It sounds like LP from Run the Jewels. And I love that, you know, this Run the Jewels, a duo of Killer Mike and LP, black guy and a white guy, is used as basically the theme music for Power Man and Iron Fist. It's great. It's thematically apt and it gets the blood pumping a lot better than the RTJ song that they use in Iron Fist does.
I think that you can see Luke Cage showing up to rescue Danny's idiot white boy privileged ass is the sign that he really is the moral center of this series. I mean, Jessica is in some ways I hesitate to draw the difference to bring up. I think a lot about the difference between reformers and revolutionaries, and but I think Jessica is sort of propelled to be, has the energy to be one, where she's like, I'm going to blow this up because it's not right. Her energy tends to be very angry and very personal and very specific. And Luke is just like, I'm going to make the world a better place every day, every way, every action. My goal is to make the place safe and to stop BS when I see it and to be on the side of the right all the time. And, that is what I really love about he's showing up and doing the work in this series, you know?
I think your comparison, I think you both made comparisons to Captain America with him, and it's like, he is the core that you can build a strap a bunch of misfits around that and hopefully build a functional team or family. Because really any other combination of these folks without him does not seem like they're going to be able to function as a unit for any period of time.
I mean, to be honest, I don't see Luke and Matt getting along that well precisely because they both have such a strong sense of what right and wrong are. And the first time those come into conflict, we're going to have problems.
Well, and plus, Matt flouts the law on a daily basis. Luke was framed and has had no opportunity to flout the law because the one time he tried to do things by the book, he got thrown in jail.
Mm-hmm. It's also worth pointing out that Matt is a white man. And the consequences for a white man blithely ignoring the law, a college-educated professional white man with connections blithely ignoring the law, versus a black man who has chosen to reinvest in a historically poor and black community, they're very different things. I don't think that's ever going to get called out explicitly over the course of the series, but I do think it's really interesting that instead of Matt, who was ostensibly Catholic and very moral and very agonizing, he's not going to emerge as the moral leader on this team. It's pretty evident already that Luke is the heart of the team and that Luke is the guy who will do things because for the sake of them being right.
Well, Luke is the only one acting for externally focused motives. Yeah. So Matt thinks he's saving the world, but he's really trying to satisfy his own hunger for his own anger.
Yeah.
Jess is ostensibly, you know, helping the architect's family, but really this is another coping mechanism for her.
Yeah.
And Danny thinks he's out to save the world, but really he's just trying to prove his place in it.
Yeah.
He's trying to constantly prove he's worthy of this responsibility he's been given.
Danny's
Luke
motive
is a preacher's son. Go ahead.
Danny's motive is like, sounds the most in that he wants to take down the hand. It seems the closest to, I want to save the world, but he is the furthest from saving the world, right? He is the most.
Also, Danny is not taking down the hand because he recognizes that they are invidious and everywhere and warp thousands of people's
lives. He's
doing
it because some monk told him that his job is to take down the hand. And like, he doesn't even know what that means. Right?
And he's also, and he's like, they killed my parents. And I'm like, really? That's like the least of what the hand has done on a regular
basis.
Get
over it, Bruce Wayne.
Meanwhile, Luke is a preacher's son. Luke sees suffering every day. And Luke is just, you know, Luke being invulnerable gives Luke the strength and security in himself. Mm-hmm. And I love that Luke's invulnerability is kind of a metaphor for his own unshakable confidence.
Yeah.
And you know, he is kind of the most complete as a person. Not that he hasn't had these horrible traumas and gone through hell and back.
But the fact is he's got his life together, right? He's got his self together, I think is a good way of putting it. His sense of self is intact. And we've already talked about the fact that Matt is unable to reconcile these parts of himself that he considers to be the core constituent parts of him. And Danny is 12, so he is still trying to figure out how you define intrinsic internal selfhood. Mm-hmm. And with Jessica, I think that when she's trying to help the architect's family and watch out for them, what she's hoping to do is to take these parts of herself that give her the most trouble and push them out where they can do good. And so Jessica knows that she's broken, and it would kill her before she asked for help to fix it. So she's trying to fix it on her own. And so it's one step forward and two steps back, one step forward, two steps back with her. And I think the reason she connects so well with Matt is because they're both fractured along similar lines. Mm-hmm. They're both very angry people. They both use their altruistic impulses to excuse their more self-indulgent behavior.
Mm-hmm. I just think back to the first episode when we're kind of checking in with all these characters, and it's like Luke is just getting out of jail where he has been wrongly imprisoned, and Claire's like, "So you gonna get a job?" And like when like Foggy and folks are checking in with Matt, it's like, "So Matt, you still going out at night, being a weirdo?"
In between using your trust fund money to, you know, be an incredibly successful lawyer pro bono.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Luke lives in a world with consequences, which is interesting because he's the one guy who can't really get hurt. Nothing can touch him, but he sees how everything touches the people around him. Mm-hmm. And I love the way, I mean, Luke got into this to help a kid and help the kid's mom. He wanted to do something. He wanted to do right by the mom.
Because the mom has suffered so much. He's like, I just want to make sure her suffering stops, and I want to make sure they can't touch her.
It seems like Luke, I mean, they play him a lot as a loner, but he is kind of less alone than any of the other characters, right?
Yeah.
The other characters.
Luke is rooted in a community.
Yes.
Yeah.
And even when he, you know, I mean, he leaves Harlem and he's hanging out at that bar with his love interest when he's kind of on the hiding out from stuff, but he has a love interest, right? Like he builds connections wherever he goes, as opposed to these other characters that are just like, you know, I'm just going to sleep in my horrible apartment at night and then go out and do whatever, which could be Jessica or Matt.
No, they're more alike than, And this is a thing that I'm not sure the writers necessarily intended, but the chemistry between the two actors was pretty, and it wasn't like romantic chemistry, but the way they play off each other in scenes was just obvious. Like there are sparks whenever those two talk, and you want to see what kind of points they'll score off each other. And I don't know if it was deliberate on purpose, but the parallels between Jessica and Matt are both right there. Like they have loved ones who are really ambivalent about the stuff that makes these people who they are and watch out for them even when they don't want to be watched out for. They're deeply angry people. They're really ambivalent about the physical abilities that set them apart in the first place. They're both deeply incomplete people. Both of them suspect that they're not worthy of being loved because they've done terrible things. You know, it's the more I think about it, the more profound the parallels are.
Which is probably why it's so much fun to see them together every moment they're on screen.
Yes.
Even in that chase scene where it doesn't really work, part of the frustration is just that they're not together. They're working at cross purposes. And the moment they start interacting, you know, you just start enjoying it so much more.
I was a little disappointed with how long they made us wait for them all to get together as a group, given the short length of this miniseries. But it felt so satisfying to finally see them all together, and you know, and I did kind of, I enjoyed the trip along the way to that point. Like it was fun seeing all these different threads that are happening across New York, and it made the world feel very lived in. It reminded me a lot of the things I like about Game of Thrones, where we have all these different threads, and it's really exciting when those threads feel like they might get close to each other and connect, and you might see characters who've, you know, been doing their own thing for a long, long time finally in the same room talking to each other. So, you know, I guess I think I was disappointed at first that like they weren't a team at the end of episode one, but I am excited that they're a team, or at least they're physically in the same elevator at the end of episode three.
Yeah, there are two great joys in TV series that I've found. One of them is checking in on characters that you like that you haven't seen in a while. And the first two episodes use that to get to the joy that comes in episode three, which is seeing characters who have been separate come together.
Yes, that's always my favorite part, is watching them cross paths and interact. And it's and the reason I like it is because it never tracks with how you expect, but it makes, like, when it's done well, it makes a whole lot of sense.
And I just wanted to say that the casting top to bottom in this show is so good. Luke's story is made stronger because, for example, the guy playing Cole is so good in so little screen time. He gets one scene with Luke in this episode, but you don't forget him. Even after that amazing fight scene, he lends such depth and such humanity. It could be a caricature. It could be easy to play that as a cliche, but he doesn't. He is fully human in his whole scene and his whole conversation with Luke in a way that really tears your heart out.
Yeah, it's
And the scene with Cole's mom is just it could be melodramatic, but it's not, because somehow you really do feel her pain. And I love that, like, Luke, when he connects with her using religion, and it's not a feint. It's not a put on for him. It's something that he sincerely believes. And you remember, oh yeah, Luke was a preacher's son.
Yes. Which is the kind of parallel, like, Jessica Jones basically uses an act and a lie to get her lead on the puzzle. Luke is who he is.
Yeah, Luke just walks through the door, and Luke is comfortable with who he is, and that's why he's able to do that in a way that Jessica and Matt are never going to be able to do. Yeah.
And Danny uses the fact that, like, he, you know, his dad's name to talk to somebody. So,
well, Danny is such a child. I mean, that's part of it. I keep trying to figure out why he's written like a 12-year-old boy, and I don't know if we're supposed to see him as adult and competent in kung fu situations, because his frame of reference for adulthood is solely with the Crane Mother monastery, or if, again, the writers just have no idea what to do with this, or what the deal is. But again, you have three grown-ups, two of whom are fractured and working through their stuff, and one of whom is just trying to work in a world that's stacked against him.
Let's call it one and a half grown-ups. So
are you saying that Matt and Jessica are like 0.25 of a grown-up each?
Depends on the time of day. So.
Okay, so you've got a few people who are arguably adult, and then you've got Danny, who is just, this is my company because it was my dad's company, and now I want things, and I'm not expecting him to have spent all of that time in his private jet going around the world, like watching Michael Douglas in Wall Street movies to figure out how to act in a boardroom, but all of his behavior is just so deeply adolescent. I don't know what the point of that is. Or this early in the series, I don't know what the point is.
I think the point is, one, they were just trying to maintain continuity with his characterization in Iron Fist. They can't suddenly have him be, I guess they might have been able to get away with it. Oh, he's traveled the world. He's more mature now.
He said Colleen to beat some sense into him for a year. Yeah,
but I think it would have been too jarring for people who didn't see the Defenders to come back for Iron Fist season two, assuming anyone comes back for Iron Fist season two, and suddenly have this whole other Danny Rand there.
I think the aspect of the adolescence that's so kind of weird is that it's not something that any of the other characters seem troubled by or comment on or make note of in any way, right?
Exactly.
Like why are the Wards, or why isn't Ward or Colleen or anybody calling him on his garbage, right?
Yeah.
Well, Jess does to some extent, but mostly she's busy making fun of Daredevil.
Yeah.
I would argue, just from a story engine perspective, having a total idiot who likes to run off and get into trouble is a great story engine. Sanjuro by Akira Kurosawa is one of my favorite movies. And part of the joy of that movie is seeing Toshiro Mifune's grizzled samurai interacting with all these young, eager samurai who are like, we're going to run off and do the stupidest possible thing. And he's like, oh, you guys are going to be the death of me. Fine, I'll go along so you don't get killed. And I think Danny is the young idiot samurai here, and the other characters are the ones, it's more entertaining to see them play off him if he's a naive than if he's super competent.
And I think it works better in Defenders, where he's part of a group I think it did not work well as where he was the lead protagonist.
Oh yeah. So no. It's great when they can, when his deficits become a character, not bad writing, but his character, and that other characters can play off that, call him for it, react to it in ways that make him more interesting and kind of probe and challenge him.
See, this is why I really like Luke's conversation with him, is because Luke very patiently does try to walk Danny through, you know, the kind of realizations that grownups have, and tries gently to steer him to the place where he can interact with the world like an adult who actually lives in New York City. And it's, again, that scene says a lot about Luke, and I am looking forward to, in subsequent episodes, seeing if any of it actually rubbed off on Danny in any way, shape, or form.
Ron Howard voice. It didn't.
It didn't. You know, we'll see. I also am looking forward to episodes 4 and subsequent ones, precisely because watching Danny around people like Matt and Jess, who call everybody on everything, is going to be a whole lot of fun. And,
oh, yes.
And we'll see how that goes. I think we have actually talked about this this episode for almost 50 minutes, which is a long time to talk about an episode that was actually only 50 minutes long. So let's just agree that Matt Murdock needs to up his mask game and draw this episode to a close. Thank you guys for listening to DefendoCast. I was Lisa Schmeiser, and with me as always were Tony Sindelar and the outstanding Nathan Alderman in for Phil Mozelak this week. Thank you, Nathan, for taking time out and discussing this with us. I loved talking set decoration with you.
It was my considerable pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh my gosh. I hope to see you in future episodes too.
That's great. Moe's hopes to be back soon. He's dealing with a bunch of things, so we will get him back when we can get him back. And we may have some additional guests, as well as hopefully having the three of us all back reunited.
Yeah. So. Since the Defenders brings in people from four different TV shows, we can bring in people from all sorts
anything
of podcasts.
Can happen, people.
That's how this works. Exactly. And anything will. Good night, guys.